yesterday, looking at the Gemara on Vav Med Aleph, and the Gemara raises issues of what is the power of Tfisa. That if somebody in a situation where you have Shnei Mochs and Batalis, and we are acknowledging some kind of Chazaka or Quasi Chazaka or Tfisa, various ways we've seen throughout this parak to look at what connection each party has to the half talis. So how does Tfisa relate to that? If one party grabs their half, grabs the other half, takes the whole thing, so to what extent does that affect things? And the Gemara kind of segues from there into Hekdish. If one person is going to be Makdish his half, or the other half, or actually Makdish the whole thing, so to what extent does Hekdish parallel Tfisa? Both of them involve sending the item into the rishus of another party. So the Gemara essentially has three ways of paralleling them. Right? Either we could say that Tfisa doesn't work at all, and therefore Hekdish doesn't work either. The Gemara is clear that we're talking about Hekdish without Tfisa, that you either grab it from the guy, or you are Makdish it. And the Gemara has three ways of looking at the relationship, that either neither of those work, or they both work. That if you're Tofes it, it stays with you, and if you're Makdish it, it becomes Hekdish. Or basically a split decision that, yes, maybe we say if you're Tofes it, then fine, it becomes in your property for whatever purposes we're talking about. But that wouldn't necessarily follow that Hekdish works the same way. Because Hekdish, we know, there's a dual requirement. You have to both own it in terms of title, and you have to have control over it. It has to be shelo b'rishuso. That's why, for example, if somebody has stolen property that the owner has not been miyayish from, so then neither party can be makdish it, because the owner doesn't have control right now, and the ganav isn't the owner. So to here, maybe even if you're going to say that tfisa could work, it shouldn't necessarily follow that hektish works. Maybe there's a lack of b'rishuso. So then the Gemara of Vav Med Beis brings up a related case where the Gemara talks about this merchatz, this mesusa, to have a menatsu alei betray, that there were two people who were fighting over ownership of this merchatz. So essentially, what kind of situation is that? Well, what should the halacha be if these two people are fighting over a merchatz? Kol dal gvar situation, right? So we came from a yachloku situation, and we went to a kol dal gvar situation. Now again, that itself is interesting, right? The assumption that the two cases should be parallel to that extent. And really, this is one of the major things we're going to do in this sugya, just highlight some of the interesting assumptions that are being made and the interesting parallelisms that are being drawn. So the kol dal gvar situation also, we should say, tfisa is the same thing. It's not so obvious, right? Because kol dal gvar, you might think, is much more susceptible to tfisa playing a role. But maybe that's part of how kol dal gvar works in general. And we saw when we talked about kol dal gvar that there's a whole machlokas in the Rishonim whether it's final or not. Perhaps after one party has called on gvar, has gvard, so then the other party still can ungvar it and can overgvar it. So it's perhaps a continuing process. So to say that the yachloku premise, where we said it from the very beginning that maybe if we have ochsin or we have whatever the rules are for yachloku, that Bezdin can't allow a kol dal gvar kind of situation. So it's especially surprising to find the Gemara somewhat paralleling them here. But in any event, so the two people are fighting over this merchatz, and hayomer didihu, v'hayomer didihu, each one says it's theirs, kam chad minayu akdishu. So one of them got up and decided to be makdishit. So what was the reaction of the rabbis? Parshim miner of Chananya v'b'yoshia, v'kulu rabbanim. All the rabbis said were a little bit worried that this taka was effective, that maybe this is hektish now, so they stayed away from it. So when you get to Rav Chista, you should ask him, what's the story? So Rav Nuna, in the middle, he said that this is a Mishnah, that we have the following points. On the one hand, Zef Safik Bechoros, you have an animal that you're not sure if it's a bechor, right? Which is easy enough to imagine how that happens, because your animal gives birth, and they won't give you a straight answer. The animal won't give you a straight answer as to whether it's had any previous children. So you don't know whether this animal is a bechor or not. So this is a situation where a safek is pretty easy to imagine a safek coming up. So echad b'chor adam, v'echad b'chor behema, bein tahorim, bein temeim, hamotzi mechaveiro, olav haraya. So whatever the circumstances are, so we say that the burden of proof is on whoever is not holding it. So if it's in the hands of the original owner, so the burden of proof is on the kohen, and if the kohen has it, so apparently the burden of proof should be on the owner. So v'taniya la, we also learned in the Braisa, surim begiza v'avoda, that there is a prohibition of giza and avoda, which makes you sound like, what? That it has a status like hektish. Rashi emphasizes here misafik, since we don't know shema kachim heim. So v'ha'achad amr, haven't we said, takfu kohen ein motzien oso miyado, that if a kohen comes and grabs it, so we let him keep it. Diksani hamotzi alav haraya. That if we just said that the person who has it, it's on the burden of the other guy to prove, so apparently takfu kohen, he gets to keep it. We leave it with him. V'chilo takfu asur b'giza b'avoda, and either way, it's asur b'giza b'avoda. So what does that show you? So that seems to show you that hektish should have its effect, that it's considered to be enough connected to hektish that a person doesn't have to actually hold it in order for it to be hektish right away. So Amalei Rabba, Kedushas Bechor Kamras. So Rabba responds to him, that's not really such a good proof. Why not? Because what's the circumstance there? Kedushas Bechor. So Kedushas Bechor, what's the difference between Kedushas Bechor and other situations? What's the difference between Kedushas Bechor and everything else? It's inherently Kadosh. The expression is Kadosh Mirecha. So it doesn't need the human involvement in order to make it Kadosh. So the Gemara follows, so even if we're going to say that we'll take it back from the Kohen, so we might still say that we'll take it back from the Kohen, but there still will be a hektish status because a Bechor is unique, that the Kedusha comes on its own. So some have asked, and say this morning, some of the guys asked that that's such a good answer that it seems obvious. Right? That's actually a clear distinction between Bechor and everything else. So why do we even think for a minute that that might be a proof of anything? So what seems to be happening here is, you see, the Gemara is mapping out various details of how property is going to be assigned here. That if you say the hektish works, so what are you saying? So you're saying that whatever connection one party has to this property, together with his hektish, is enough to put this item in the rishus of hektish, in the rishus of the kohen, so to speak. So the question was, what can we glean from there, from Bechor? So here you have a Bechor, a situation where we don't know if it was a Bechor or not. And yet the Gemara says, well, we see that we have to treat it like it's possibly hektish and it's also begiza v'yavoda. So doesn't that show you that the suffix seems to be tilted towards the kohen? So the Gemara's response is that, no, that's kadosh me'aleh. So how could you have said differently? So you could have said that, in general, what does hektish mean? It means that I am committing to give something to the Beis HaMikdash. So that creates a chiyah for me to give it. But maybe until I give it, it's in my possession. And it's not considered to be the ownership of the kohen. Now, the phrase the Gemara invokes to push that a little bit in the other direction is, what's the phrase from the previous Amud? It's amiraso legavoa kemisir lehejit ami, that to a certain extent the nature of hektish is that the very act of Amira, the very act of dedicating it, already puts it to some degree in the Rishus of Hektish. Now, is that a Mamanist concept, or is that a Kadshim concept? Or are the two linked? That's a little bit the underlying question in this Gemara. Are we talking about in Hochos Choshen Mishpat is now the property of the Beis HaMikdash? Or are we saying that in Hilchos Kadshim it's as if it's already in the Beis HaMikdash, or does one get defined by the other? And Rav Shimon Shkap, for example, in the Shari Osher, he assumes that the underlying issue in this Gemara, and once the Gemara segues into Hektish and into Tafu Kohen, is to what extent is the Hektish defined by the Mamanis or vice versa? So, for example, let's say Klapei Shmaya Galia, let's say HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows that the truth was with one party in terms of the Bechor, or in terms of the Beis HaMerchetz, whatever it is. So we know that God can tell you, Eliyahu Navi can tell you the truth is one way. So is that going to affect the Hektish question on any level? Will it follow whoever the real owner is? Or should we say no, that if Choshen Mishpat comes and tell us to behave a certain way, then that will decide who gets to be Makishit, what connection the Kohen has, etc. So, for example, the question of why did the Gemara not think it was obvious about Kadosh Merachim, why was that something that we had to even be told? So perhaps the question is, what does Kadosh Merachim mean? Right? To say that the Bechor is Kadosh before it's born, it's born holy. So what does that mean? Like Shimshon, right, essentially. So what does that mean? Does that mean it has, it's already, the Kohen already owns it, so to speak, and it's just, you have to give the Kohen his property? Or we could say, no, that without your having to say anything, there's an obligation to give this animal to the Kohen. You didn't need to dedicate it for that obligation to be there. But still, until you have, it's yours. And that essentially seems to be the question in the Gemara. And then when the Gemara says, that's Kadosh Merachim, so that throws a little bit of question into how good of a proof it is, that maybe that means it's even further within the Rishus of the Kohen. So then the Gemara goes on to bring a point about Pidgin Petr Chamor. But let's say you have an animal that's also a Safek Hekdish, and that animal gets mixed in with the animals that you are, or even that before it gets mixed in, you intentionally want to use it as part of what you're counting for Meiser Behema. Right? Every one out of every 10 Behemas is going to be a part of Meiser. So can you use a Safek Hektish animal as part of that? In other words, that Safek Hektish animal, same question, is that a property of the owner or is it a property of the Kohen? So since, as the Gemara points out, that you can do that, right, what's the next line of the Gemara? What is it, Rav Chanani brings that point? Right, and what was Rabba's point of view? That he needs to be helped by this din? Right, what's Rabba's position? That Motzian, right? That it's not the Kohen's property. So how can you prove his point? Because that as part of the Maisa Behema, you can also include the Sveikos. If you're going to say that we leave it with the Kohen, so then Amayin Nichnas and Ladir Nimsas Epotim Amona Amona Shal Kohen. So you're going to end up using the Kohen's property as part of what you're counting in order to get your Maisa. Doesn't seem to be right. Presumably when you're counting what you have in order to give Maisa, you have to only use your own property. You can't use the property that already belongs to the Kohen. So if this works, apparently the Kohen does not yet have a kinyan, so to speak, in what's going on here. So what's the conclusion of the halacha? Who wins then? Tafu Kohen, Motzin, or Ein Motzin Miyado? How do you read that Gemara? What'd you say, David? Okay, so but if I had to ask you what the Gemara just told us, what would you say? Sounds like Motzian, right? So because the Gemara said that here's a good proof, which seems to be undisturbed, that it's not really the Kohen's. So let's take it back from him, Motzian. Now what's the problem if we use the little letter method of Psak? Then where does that take us? Look at the letter in the Gemara. Ein Motzian. Right, why is that the case? Because where does the little letter take you to? Takes you to the Rambam. So the Rambam disagrees with Tosfos. If you saw, Tosfos reads the Gemara the way it sounds like. That Mishnah was the conclusive proof that Motzin Miyado, that it's not the Kohen. While the Rambam doesn't pass in that way. Rambam paskins ein motziu naso miyad. So that's an interesting point in general. If you had a chance to look, that Rambam was on the Mar Makomos. So I'll just share with you that the Shmaisa addresses this. And the Shmaisa, this is in Shmaisa Dalid, Parak Hey. Maybe we'll just read this two paragraphs here. It's really three paragraphs. I'm just going to focus on two. So we'll just look at them together quickly. So the Shmaisa addresses this deviation that the Rambam seems to paskin against the conclusion of the Gemara, if that's the way we should read it. So the Shmaisa says here, Rambam pasuk besafik b'chor dim tafas hakohen ein motzi miyado. So the later Sfarim, if you look in the Kesef Mishnah, you look in the Sfarim elsewhere, so they ask against him that this is against what the Gemara sounds like, Parakama de Messiah Davav, Amarabal, Menlocha, Tokfu Kohen Motsino Sumiyod, Amar Hanani Larabba, Tani Messiah, Fakus Niklas Nadir Lissasser, Visa Datafu Kohen Motsino Sumiyod, Amar Knas Nadir, Nimsa Zapotamanam Shal Kohen, and Shumbasugi. So it sounds like the Gemara is telling us that in a situation of Safik Bechor, Tfisa should not be effective. The Kohen should not be allowed to keep it. And here the Rambam seems to be passing against that position of the Gemara. So says the Shmaisa. We've mentioned, I think, in the past, you know, the Shmaisa in general intimidates us college students and high school students, because they always tell you that in high school that the Shmaisa wrote the Shmaisa when he was 17. You should at least read the Shmaisa by the time you're 17, and it's hard enough to read, let alone to write. So you have to say that the Shmaisa, even though these were the speeches he gave for his Sheva Brachos, the seven nights of his Sheva Brachos when he was 17, so there is a... you have to also assume that he revised it and he updated it later, because this next paragraph makes it pretty much impossible that this was either when he was 17 or when he was at his Sheva Brachos. Because the next paragraph says, Ubni Hanavon, Yosef Duber, Neriyar Hakon. So he quotes his son. So however young he was when he had a son, the chances that if he was 17 years old and had a son who was on a madriga that he could be quoting in the Sheikh Shmaisa, so then they're really trying to hit you over the head with how intimidating the Sefer is. And not only did he write it when he was 17, but he had a son who was already holding more than you are. So that's already scary. But also the assumption was that at a Sheva Brachos he also didn't have children. So you have to assume that this is updated and revised. So he quotes his son. So what does his son say? That after Echzali b'Yishuv Dvarav. So what I think is Pshat. So this relates to the Gemara's answer. It says the Yeshal Hakshos my Medam Hashas Safek Bechor L'Safek Pidyon Peter Chamur. In the case with a Maestro, so you have an animal that was possibly used as a pigeon for a Petah Chamor, so maybe it should have a Kaddish status. When it comes to Bechor, Safek Bechor, less lehu labailim chezkes marakama. That when you have a Bechor, so since it is Kaddish Mirachim, it's born holy, so there never was a chezkes marakama for the owner. He never had the status of being considered the original owner in halacha. Is that such an obvious point? No, it's a chiddush a little bit, right? To say that we won't even give him the credit of not only does he not own it now, but he was never the owner. It was born not his property at all. It was created not his property. Doesn't even have the status of a marakama. Sharei miyad kishanolad sveiko imo. That the moment this animal was born, it was born in its situation of suffix. It never had a moment of life when it was not in a doubtful status. So there was never a time when the owner, even though he might be the owner, because it's a Safik Bechor, but there was never a time when the owner could say unabashedly, I am the undisputed owner of this animal. So therefore, there isn't even a Marakama. So there, the animal was owned once upon a time and was used as pigeon for Petah Chamor. Now, even though you could say the opposite of this, and you could say in the context of Bechor, there is Cheskes Marakama, that when the baby was a fetus, when it was in the mother's body, so then it was Chulin. Right? Then it wasn't holy yet. It has to be born first, at least. So we said a second ago that it was born holy, and it was born in a situation of doubt. but at least let it be born. So until it's born, it's not holy. So shouldn't that give the owner a status of marakama? She'ein b'chori kadosh achiyetze la'avir ha'olam. It's not going to be holy until it actually enters into the atmosphere of the world. Mikol makom lav chezkas bailim mamish chashiv. That's not considered to be a chezkas bailim in the genuine sense. Kamo b'pidjin petach hamor. D'b'mayimo havalei davar shlo bal yolam. It's as if its status is not really existing yet. It is a future item, which is, again, not an obvious point at all. I mean, this is the physical fetus that will grow into an actual animal. So to say it's a davar shlo bal yolam, and that we can't credit you with any kind of historical ownership is a chiddush. Kamo shekasev v'shulchan aruch ha'shemishpat v'yemkei lo havi d'bailim ela agav imo. So its only connection to the bailim is through the ownership of the mother. Avigam b'chedusha pnei Yeshua sham b'sugi hev v'shem arash b'tshuvosa avigam b'chor lo chashiv cheskes marikama. So essentially there are a few interesting things about this shmaisa. So first of all, the thrust of what the Shmaisa is saying, which is what other Achronim say as well, just in terms of letting us rest easy about why does the Rambam contradict the Gemara, so the general category of responses is that the proof is not so conclusive. The Gemara lets you think that it's a conclusive proof against the position of Ein Motzi and Miyado, and apparently the Rambam didn't think it was so conclusive. It didn't think that it was so relevant. But the problem is, again, if you use an answer like this, which is based on differentiating between Bechor and other types of Hekdesh, so again, the answer is unique to Bechor. So Tokfu Kohen by Bechor, so then Ein Motzi and Miyado, but if there were other types of Hekdesh, it would be somewhat more of an open question. So the Shmais is just one of many approaches and many of those who resolve the Rambam by saying that the Rambam assumes the Gemara is not as conclusive as it sounds like. The answer, the refutation, is not as strong a refutation as it appears to be. You can upend it, and that's how you do it. And this is a fascinating way to do so, and perhaps a little bit of a questionable way to do so, by extending what the Gemara says, that Bechor Redi is Kadosh Mirechem, and that's why it's also Begizav Yavoda, doesn't necessarily tell you anything about its nature in terms of the Kohen's ownership. So here we're going to go even further with that and say that the original owner is not halachically the original owner. He doesn't have a cheskes marakama at all to credit him in this suffix. Yeah?
Since there's no cheskes marakama, therefore it's automatically the Kohen?
So therefore it's more likely to be the Kohen. And therefore to say that his tfisa is significant, what's his tfisa going against? It's not going against the cheskes marakama even. Right, so in other situations where, let's say, you have the mesusa or whatever it is, let's say, even more strongly in the previous case of Vav Mer Aleph, we have Shnei Mofsin, and one of them is Makdishit. So you want to say that if the Kohen grabs it, we should be Ein Motzi Miyado? Maybe not, because that Kohen is working against something. Working against whether we call it a Chazaka, or we'll call it a Cheskes Marakama, maybe. We'll call it, which we've established in the past, Cheskes Marakama seems to be less than a Mukhzak. So we'll say something like that. But here, it's even less than that. When it comes to the Bechor, the owner is not even credited with a Cheskes Marakama because he never had an indisputed claim to this animal. May Taka be his.
In any other case, it would be Mumtien.
You'd have to say like that, because not necessarily explicitly, but you'd have to say that this is unique to Bechor, essentially because of that. So in the case of Shnei Mochsen Batalis, so the Rambam has a little bit, if you saw it, point to the Rambam and the Nimuka Yosef, the Rambam has a little bit of a confusing psak, but when the Gemara gives the case of one person grabs a talus and the other person grabs it back, so if there's a protest the second time, so the Rambam says it reverts to its Yachloku status, which seems to be at odds with this Tukfu Kohen shot, where Tukfu Kohen, the Kohen gets to keep it. So that could be a halacha that's unique to Hekdesh, or especially with here, it could be halacha that's unique to Kedushas Bechor, even within Hekdesh. So as we mentioned, a number of perspectives come out from this Gemara, and it's worth just being aware of. So one of the underlying issues, especially in the latter part of the sugya, is the interaction between the various areas of halacha here, between Hekdesh and Choshen Mishpat, and should one define the other, or vice versa. And by the way, just to give a little bit of a dimion, so again, maybe in a Bekiah's perspective, Next semester we'll talk a little bit about ribbis, so we'll find some context in the semester to talk about ribbis a little bit. So this is a related issue when it comes to ribbis. So there is a Torah prohibition to charge interest and to pay interest. And that is often treated by most as a Yoredeya concept. That if two parties want to contract with each other, that I'm going to lend you money and you're going to pay me interest. So in terms of Choshen Mishpat, such a deal should work. But the Torah prohibits it as a Yoredeya, so the halachas of ribbis are in Yoredeya. And again, we'll probably find some venue to discuss this over the course of next semester a little bit, but the halachas of ribbis seem to not be mamonos halachas, even though they involve money, but they seem to come from a different realm of halacha. So it opens up a question, all right, so I lent you money, you paid me ribbis, so I'm not really allowed to charge ribbis, you shouldn't have given it to me, etc., etc., but you did. So now I have the ribbis. Can I be Mekadish and Isha with that? Is it mine monetarily, even though it's Asur? How do these two areas of halacha interact with each other? So there is a strong view, and I'm not going into all of it now because it's a different sugya, but there is a strong view, the Mishnah Melech talks about, the Stipel talks about, and others, that yes, that can be Mekadish and Isha without ribbis. That in Choshen Mishpat, the money is money. In Yoredeya, it was Asur to take, and in Yoredeya, I have to give it back. Even that's a little complicated. Your day was also to take, let's say. But in Choshen Mishpat, it was a genuine deal. It's not gzeila. If it's gzeila, I can't do it, right? If I stole money from you, I couldn't be Mekadish and Isha with stolen money. So what's the difference? Torah tells me not to steal. The Torah tells me not to take ribbis. But yet, apparently, according to many, not everyone, if I took ribbis, I could use that to be Mekadish and Isha. So apparently that view holds there's some bifurcation and there's some separation between the arenas here, that even though in Yoredeya it's an Aveira, in Choshen Mishpat it was a legitimate deal. Which is a very complex scenario. So too here, if there is Hekdish, what does Hekdish mean? Does it mean that the item is sanctified in Hilchos Kedushin, but Choshen Mishpat has its own rules? Or does the Choshen Mishpat, in terms of the Klali HaSveikos, and in terms of just Hamotzi Mechaver or Olav Haraya, what's the interaction between Hamotzi Mechaver or Olav Haraya and Hekdish? And in which direction does it go? If the Hilchos Hekdish tells me something, does that define things for the purposes of Mamonos? So it's a very rich area for exploration, and there are a couple of contexts in which it can come up, so our Gemara is, on one level, addressing that. On a different level, just without focusing so much on the Hekdish, the approach that Rabbi Chanan Wasserman talks about in the Kovetz Aris and others is that this plugs right back into our Shneim Ochsin discussions, is what is the status of a Chazaka? If somebody is Muchzak in something, if somebody has an item in his possession, so we know, okay, Emotzi Mechaver Lo Haraya, that you can't take Mammon from a Muchzak, without a good proof, without Eidim, you cannot do it with Rov, you have all kinds of rules, you can't be Motzim and Amosah. What does that mean? Does it mean that halachically we assume it is definitely yours? That a Mochzak is a Vadai statement? Or do we say, no, it doesn't really mean that, it means something in between. It means it's a Suffolk yours, but that's more than nothing, and that's more than the other guy has? Or does it mean neither of those? Maybe it means that we just have a rule that misafek, we're not motzi mamon. So if the other guy only has a safek, he doesn't have anything to work with to take your money away from you. But doesn't say anything about the original muchzak's actual ownership. Now we've also discussed in the past, and this is relevant, that we differentiate sometimes in terminology between a muchzak and a tofes. And we said that both the muchzak and the tofes are holding on to something, but they have different levels of significance to them. And the tofes, we know, doesn't have necessarily a historical connection to this item. So there's a certain degree of status quo recognized for the tofes, and presumably more for the muchzak. So it's a question, where exactly does muchzak fit into the spectrum? Is it similar to a tofes? Is it based on just a reluctance to upset the status quo? but maybe more powerfully granted? Or is it significantly different? Does it mean that we really see the halacha telling us that the mochzak is considered to be the vadai owner of this item? So that's unlikely to be the case. Unlikely to say that he's definitely the owner of the item, because we know that it's certainly possible that a mochzak is not the owner, and that it's hard to assume that that's what the halacha should be telling us. The Maharik was the lone voice. The Maharik maintained that a mochzak is considered to be the vadai owner of something, and others presumably disagreed. It seems like a lot of the Rishonim viewed it differently. Because, for example, you have the following statement. If you learn the sugya of Ein Holchem B'Mamon Achar HaRov, so in the third parak of Bava Kamma is a Tosfos, and it's Tosfos in Sanhedrin, there's Tosfos in a few places, that explain Ein Holchem B'Mamon Achar HaRov as follows. And we mentioned this a few weeks ago, focusing on the Rov part of the sentence. And now we'll make a similar point focusing on the Chazaka part of the sentence. Right. Why is it, a lot of the most common explanation in the Rishonim of why we don't use a rov to take out mamon from someone is because the Rishonim have an expression, smoch miuto l'chazak, that the muchzak wins because he's got two things in his favor, the chazaka and the miut. Do you remember we discussed this in the context of migo a little bit? That what does that mean, the miut? A miut is nothing. Why is a miut powerful? Since when do you have the power of the minority? What does that mean? Smoch miyud l'chazaka. So what it seems to mean is that the fact that there's a minority in your favor, whatever percentage it is, a significant minority, let's call it 10%, but the fact there's a 10% chance that you're right, what does that mean? It means that the other guy is not an absolute. It means that Rove is not ever a definite establishment of truth. Again, this is something we said in the context of Migo, that Rove cannot ever, just because we follow Rove because there's a lot of reason to follow Rove, there's a lot of basis to follow Rove, it's the most reasonable approach, usually. But it doesn't mean that it's definitely the case, because if there was definitely the case, there'd be no such thing as a Miut. The existence of any significant Miut means, by its very definition, that a Rove is not a definite thing. There's a possibility that it's not true. So when you say the muchzak wins when he's fighting against the rov, it's because smoch miyuta l'chazaka, let's credit him with the miyut. I mean, let's credit him with the reality that a rov is not definite. Together with his chazaka, so then he should win. So we invoke that. Any question about that, Ephraim? So right, so we focused on that a few months ago in the context of Migo as a way of emphasizing that Rove is not absolute. That shows us that Rove does not mean 100%. It's not a factual reality. It's just a way of deciding a conflict. A strong way, a very good way that works in a lot of important areas, but not an absolute fact. And therefore, that recognition together with the Chazaka makes him win. So we focused on that sentence to show that Rove is not an absolute clarification. But what else do you see from here? You see that at the same time, that sentence not only casts a little bit of weakness onto Rove, it also casts a little bit of weakness onto Muchzak as well. Why? You see why? Sorry? Well, but the Miut is in the favor of the Muchzak, right? The guy wins because he's got the Muchzak and the Miut. So we said the recognition of the Miut weakens the Rove. But that sentence also weakens Muchzak at the same time. Why? Exactly, because you're saying it doesn't stand by itself. Right? Why do I need smoch miyut l'chazaka? Say chazaka. Chazaka is an absolute fact. The guy has an absolute reality of holding, of owning it. So that's why he wins. So you could read the sentence. You could also read it differently, because you could say that we're only invoking the miyut in order to define Rove, is a little bit like Ephraim just said, but it sounds like the way the Rishonim invoke it is that it's doing damage in both directions. It's weakening Rove because the Miyut exists, but the fact that we have to mention it shows that Chazaka by itself is not enough. The Chazaka is a very powerful thing. You can be Mitzarif it with other factors, and it's going to be even more powerful. But it shouldn't need any tzira if it was an absolute fact. If muchzak meant the guy holding it is the owner, so then who needs anything else? So that's the assumption, that muchzak works as something very powerful, but it's not an absolute. The Ma'arik is the minority. The Ma'arik saying that it's considered to be an absolute fact. So we know in the American jurisprudence, we have the expression, predates American jurisprudence, expression, possession is 9/10 of the law. In the Maharik's view, it's 10/10 of the law. And in the Maharik's view, it's the reality. But when we say smoch miyutu l'chazaka, that reflects this kind of idea that it's very powerful. It gives you a good presumption. But it's not 10/10, so it's not the whole law, because who knows, there are weaknesses in it. But it's a very strong factor that you can use in your favor. Hi.
The possession could mean also tefisa.
Right, so then, correct, so we have to figure out how to translate halakhically what the word possession should correspond to, but that tfiso also shows us where the spectrum could be playing off of, right? That there is, when we contrast tfiso with chazaka, so we're kind of making that point that possession could mean different things in different contexts, and sometimes we'll call it tfiso and sometimes we'll call it chazaka, or you could say that they aren't so different, and that chazaka is also something along the tefisa spectrum. You can either differentiate it greatly from tefisa and say, like the Ma'arik, that it represents real ownership, or even like others, but it represents a much stronger presumption than tefisa. Because tefisa could by itself mean, we know for a fact it doesn't mean ownership, right? We could have seen somebody be tofes, and we know that it has no connection to ownership. It could be the guy who was being tofes what was once his, but that we know that there's no connection between, if we saw a tefisa happen, right, then we know that there's no connection between his current holding of the item and his factual historical ownership. Doesn't mean there wasn't the factual ownership, but we know that the tefisa has no connection to it. So in terms of what it shows, that's a relatively weak end of the spectrum. Now we can contrast muchzak in two different ways. We could say muchzak, like the Ma'arik, means definite ownership, or no, it means possible ownership and likely ownership, which is still more than tefisa, because tefisa, we know, wasn't done in the context of it being his from beforehand. So that is very possibly what is underlying a lot of the issues in the sugya, from the beginning to the end, from the takfa echad b'fneinu to the whole takfu kohen issue, when the person is in a position of hamotzi mechaveiro alo varaya. So what does that mean? Does that mean that the halacha recognized it as actually being his? Or does it mean that, no, it's just a powerful element? Now, the Ksos also says, along the view of the Rishonim that we just said, about in Hoch HaMoman Achar Arov, that Muchzak is something that you can combine with other factors in order to make the Muchzak win. And the Nesivus disagrees with him. The Nesivus says, a third perspective, essentially, that it's not something you mix with other factors, because it's not a point card. It's not a card that's worth a certain amount of points. But it's a functional issue. Again, this is evocative of our Migo discussion. We talked about Migo Lahotzi, right? And we asked if Migo is not effective Lahotzi, is it because it doesn't have enough points? Or is it simply a procedural element? It just doesn't work that way. So too, when it comes to Muchzak, you could say Muchzak is very strong and nobody can fight it off. Or you can say that we have a reluctance in general. We're not Motzi Mamon Misafek. And that's how the Nesivus expresses it, that if somebody is only working with a safek, that's not going to let him take money away from anybody else. Without granting points to that other party, it's just simply functional. This other guy, the first guy trying to get it, doesn't have anything to work with. So therefore, it's not even effective necessarily in terms of adding it up to other things. You won't have to use the explanation of smoch miyuta l'chazaka. You simply can't be motzi mamon with a suffix. And then there could be other elements that could change that equation. So I think those are some of the highlights of what we should be aware of from this whole Tukfu Kohen discussion. Some of the fact that it's a machlokas rishonim had a paskin on this issue, the various possible interactions between the different elements, and what are some of the key questions that are being considered. And all of this, again, ties back into our opening sugi of Shnai Mochsin. So what are the assumptions when you have Shnai Mochsin Batalis and Yidu Yachloku, which are very much correlated to what are the assumptions of Muchzak? You know, do we say that a Muchzak owns what he has? Absolutely. Do we say he has a strong argument to own because of his chazaka? Do we say it's a general principle of ein motzin mamon misafek? Or we could also say a slightly different version, as Reb Chaim Shmulevitz suggested, that halachically it's a vaday, which again correlates to something we said by Yachloku. Right? We said that one way of looking at Yachloku is even if it's not factually, historically true, that the talus is 50-50, but halachically is a psak of vaday, which means in the eyes of Bezdin, each one has it. So if you want to be Mekadish and Isha with your half, if you want to do whatever you want with your half, it's halachically yours, it's vada yours. That's the way the psak of Bezdin recognizes the factual, recognizes the 50-50 split, even though it doesn't correlate necessarily to what historically happens. So you could view Chazaka that way also. We could say that Bezdin views a Muchzak as a vaday owner, even though it may not be the case that he necessarily actually historically owned it. But the reality of his chazaka is viewed in Choshen Mishpat as a vaday owner. Aaron?
So maybe it's whether or not it's a like an umdina, and it just how we establish the case, whether or not it's mochiach or something?
I don't know if I would use that language exactly, but I think if I understand correctly what you're saying, is that do we look at it as a proof that this is what the case was, in the umdina in that sense? Or do we say that, and this where the second part was a little bit more difficultly phrased, but that it's irrelevant whether this was historically the case. But the halacha recognizes muchzak as absolute ownership, and not even as a suffix. We're not even going to look at that as a suffix that we need to put the miut together with it in order to work, but we treat it halachically as if it's definitely yours, unless we had some reason to say differently. Okay, so everyone follow that more or less? All right, so we have a few more minutes. So what I'll try to do is quickly recap some of those points, and then maybe we can quickly start our chazara. We have a few minutes to mention one of the shorter points. And we'll continue chazara. I think what we'll do is maybe on Sunday we'll have shir at normal time, so I get the one last Sunday in. Him speaking at Kol Yom Rishon on Sunday, it's early, so you're certainly invited to come to that if you want to. But the topic was Tarvei Teves, so instead of breakfast, you can come to Kol Yom Rishon. So that's, I think, 9:30 to 10:30 at Kol Yom Rishon, so it doesn't interfere with our shir time. We'll have a normal shir afterwards, and maybe we'll also continue the Chazara for 5 minutes now on Sunday and Monday, and that should be enough time, I think, hopefully, to get us to where we need to. And then we'll have Chumash tomorrow. That parsha stops for no man, so we'll have Chumash tomorrow. So we'll have Chumash tomorrow as regular, and then Chazara next 2 minutes, and Sunday and Monday, and then the final on Tuesday. Okay, any questions about anything? All right. So what we discussed today? So we looked at the Gemara and Vav Amud Aleph and Vav Amud Beis about Takfu Kohen and about Takfu Echad Bifneinu, and we highlighted some of the key points about what the questions are. What is the status of Shnei Mochs and Batalis? To what extent does each one have a certain degree of connection that could allow them to seal the deal with a Tfisa, or to seal the deal with Hektish, which is comparable to Tfisa? Although not absolutely. That's why the Gemara has essentially three ways of looking at how Hektish might be played out, depending on how you hold from the Tfisa issue. And then we noted the Gemara transitions from there to the Masusa case, which is a situation of Kol Dal M'Gvar, and it's very interesting that the assumption seems to be that a Yechlokim case and a Kol Dal M'Gvar case have the same interaction with Tfisa, not at all an obvious point. And then the Gemara segues into Takfu Kohen and into bringing a proof from Safek Pidgin Petah Chamor, which raised issues of what's the connection between the Hektish Halachas and the Choshen Mishpat Halachas. Do they act independently of each other? Do they define each other in which one, in which direction? We drew a loose parallel to Ribbis, which is a Yerodeya Halacha. And there again, the question could be, what is the Mumminus? For example, also, there are some Acharonim who say that, just to give you an example of how extreme the disparity could be, that if I contract to Ribbis, so that's a genuine chov, that you have a contract between two people in a meeting of the minds, so it's a genuine chov, but a Torah asrasa. So the chov is recognized at the same time as the Torah prohibits collecting the chov. And the Chazon Ish thought that was a joke. He said, if the Torah asks it, then there's no such chov, there's no such concept. So it's possible to see them as inextricably connected. It's possible to see them as something you could look at in separate ways, and that's perhaps paralleled here to some degree. And then we talked about the question the Gemara seems to prove from the Pidyon Petach Chamor case that Takfu Kohen Motziyan Miyado. But that's contradicted by the Rambam, who paskins Ein Motziyan Miyado. And we looked at the Shmaisa, who quotes his miraculous son when the father was 17, that who says that Gemara, who says like a lot of the Achronim say, that the Rambam would have to assume the proof is not conclusive, even though it sounds like it is. And the reason it's not conclusive is because there's no Cheskas Marakama in that case, because the Bechor is Kadosh Mirechem right away, and therefore the owner is never credited even with a Cheskas Marakama. And that's not an obvious point, but he goes on to say that, and to also say that even the fetus is not considered to be the ownership of the father, or the ownership of the owner, because it is Dabar Shalom Bala Olam, and it doesn't come into this discussion at all. So therefore you really have to localize the Rambam to talking about a Suffolk Bechor, and not necessarily extend to other Hekdesh, or to other Tfisa issues in general. And then we talked about how the sugya is also viewed as terms of what does it say about Muchzak, what does it say about the idea of a Motziyin min Muchzak Misafek, a Motziyin Chaver Lavaraya, and we saw that there are essentially a couple of different ways to look at the power of Muchzak. We mentioned the Maharik, who says that it's a Vadai, that there actually is proof that this is ownership. We mentioned that it doesn't sound like that from a lot of the Rishonim, who in the context of Ein Hochmun Acharov say Smoch Miyuta L'Chazaka, the Chazaka doesn't stand on its own. It's a very powerful force when combined with other things makes it meet off a rov. And we saw the Nesivis who said differently, that it's not something to be mistarif to other things, it's just a functional principle that we don't mimotzi mamon misafik. And we mentioned also Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's perspective, that which also very strongly correlates to Shnei Mochus and Metalis ways of looking at things, that it could be considered a din vadai without having to necessarily have any presumptions about what historically has been the case. Okay, so let's just for a few minutes talk about some of the sugyas that we have to chazer still. So again, no one's come forward with anything. If there are any sugyas from before the midterm that you want me to discuss in public, please let me know, and we'll discuss them as well. But other than that, so we need to talk a little bit about Gemara Daf Beis and Beis, V'chiba Bahabata Ba'alma Kani. Does it work to acquire something through looking at it? And then the sugya of Lechzi Zuzim Iman Nakat, which is connected to the sugya of Eid Echad B'Shvua. Those are two connected points. And then the somewhat major sugya of Modiv Mikzah / Helach. And the Los Achmud was the last thing we did. We'll see if we have time to chazer that, but it's still somewhat fresh in our memory, so it's a low priority. But let's just discuss the first one, which was a relatively brief point. So the question of Chiba Habata Ba'alma Kani. So the Gemara has both a Havamina and a Maskana, so that you find both phrases in the Gemara on Daf Beis and Aleph, that Ria Ba'alma rather instead of Habata, that Ria is either Kona or not Kona. So the idea that it's Kona is challenged by the first Tosfos, based on Gemara's later on, and that the Gemara seems to say that it's not Kona, because the Gemara gives a case where somebody sees something and then tries to do a kinyan afterwards, and it's apparently only effective if the kinyan actually takes place. So it sounds like from there that Ria is not Kona. So that Tosfos discusses in the first Tosfos and says that since he does this action of falling on it or something like that, Gali Daiti Lo Nichle Mikni Achi Yagil Yado. That in other words, maybe according to this opinion, that looking at something could acquire it, but if you're going to do something else, so then you have to actually do it in order for that kinyan to take place. And we mentioned the explanation based on Rav Yosef Engel, Nisyudim LaTorah, and others, that the idea of a kinyan in general, that really the way property transfers is through das. You have the two parties, so each one agrees that one should get the property from the other, that's what makes a transfer happen. But since das is not visible, it brings back memories of Los Achmod, so we need a physical action called the kinyan, which will display the seriousness of this das. So therefore, it's possible to say that on the one hand we need that, but also that could retroactively define when the kinyan happened. So perhaps you could have thought, or you could say, that the kinyan really could take place b'habata, but we need the action later to show that there was a kinyan at that time, but then maybe retroactively it was acquired when he originally saw it. And we considered the possibility that there might be different purposes. That on the one hand, if you have two people who are making a transaction, there may be one threshold for what transfers it between the two of them, because there are no other competing parties. When you have a lost object, which anyone in the world theoretically could claim, we might need a more overt threshold of what allows a new person to lay claim to it. It may also make a difference in terms of hefker versus there actually being a seller. And we also noted that the Rambam in Hilchos Metzia, the Rambam talks about finding something. So he doesn't talk about kinyanim. He says asul yado, there has to get to his hands. But as some acharonim note, he specifically doesn't require a kinyan. And it could be there, the whole nature you're acquiring from essentially hefker. So that, on the one hand, has less of an obvious two-party system here, and there's no seller. On the other hand, we just need a way of defining that you are the one who is zoche to it as opposed to anyone else. So there are all kinds of various nuances that could be possible in terms of how that operates. The next possibility, the Tosfos then talks about the assumption that Riyah is not kone, and it quotes from a Gemara later on that says, Avot the behefker kani. So how do you reconcile those two possibilities? So Tosfos here gives an answer that many found very difficult. Just in, linguistically and conceptually, it's hard to say that this is the correct reading. Tosfos says, Hainu sha'asa maisa kolduhu kigon shagadar gedar kar. That you did something, that you built a little fence, so that's really what we mean. So the reason later Svarim are bothered by this Tosfos, it's just very hard to imagine that that's what Habata means. That if you're talking about building a little fence, so that's clearly an action that gets its own name, that deserves its own status as the Kenyan. So to say we'll call that Habata, we'll call that looking at something, it just strains the credulity a little bit. That could be considered an actual Habata. You'd have a different name for that. So many prefer the reading of the Tosfos Rid. The Tosfos Rid understands that in that context, Habata means shmira. It means that you're not just looking at something, but you're looking at it to protect it. You're looking at it, you're looking over it, you're guarding it. And therefore, even if there are actions that accompany that, but that's secondary to the fact that you are essentially taking on responsibility and protecting something with your Habata, that's a more absolute Habata than some you happen to see something. So that was one of the topics they brought up. Another topic, we'll introduce it and we'll have to continue it on Sunday. It gets into the whole concept of the Rush and Eid Echad B'Shvua, but the way that topic gets brought up, we already missed most of this, you can look at it on your own, is that there is a major machlokas Rishonim, you can look at Rashi and Tosfos and the Rif, about what does the Gemara mean when it says, Lechzi Zuzi Miman Nakat, that the Gemara has one scenario in terms of Shnei Mochsen, so two ways you could have Shnei Mochsen. You could have two people who each claim to have found something, or you could have an item which two people are fighting over that they both claim to have bought it. So it says the Gemara, if they both bought it, so then why don't we just ask the seller, then who did he get money from? So the Gemara ends up responding, he got money from both of them. But what's the Havmina there? So would the seller be Nema? So that's the whole machlokas, right? So the question is Rashi, if you look at Rashi and Tosfos and the Rif, you'll find at least three or four opinions as to how to read the Gemara. Are we saying that he has Nemanis? Should we normally assume the Mekach still has to be in his hands in order for him to have Nemanis? So could it still work here where it's no longer in his hands? There's a view in Rishonim that we're actually talking about the parties. We can even ask them that they would be Nemanis to who actually paid for it and who didn't pay for it. It's a whole tricky question because the general presumption that the mocher, if it's not biyado anymore, would not have nemanis as to who he got it from. So that I would direct you to look at the Rishonim inside to remind yourself of that, who says what. But it leads into the issue that we'll discuss more fully on Sunday, the question of, so what happens, is there any status to this mocher? And the view that Rabbeinu Tam, quoted by the Rush, and that Tosfos and the Daf, sounds like he's saying as well, is that the Mocher has enough Ne'amanis to eliminate the Shvua here. That the assumption, Yachloku B'Shvua, that the Mocher has enough credibility to say that you don't need a Shvua because I can testify that it was belongs to such and such, which opened up a whole machlokas. Is that true? If there is a Chi of Shvua, can an Eid Echad come and undo that chiyuv shvuos. That rush was a topic of discussion, so God willing, we will pick up on that on Sunday after Chumash tomorrow. Okay, I wish everyone a wonderful day. Do we have anybody who wants to lead us in davening?